The Levantine Cultural Center presents a public forum entitled Hawks and Doves in the Garden of Peace. Israeli-American author and peacemaker Miko Peled talks about his new book, The General's Son, in a public conversation with Palestinian-Lebanese-American author and UCLA professor Sari Makdisi. The program takes place on May 14, 2012. May 14th is the date Israel celebrates as its Independence Day. It falls on the eve of Nakba Day, which Palestinians and Arabs mark as the catastrophe that swallowed up 78% of historic Palestine. A Q&A follows the Peled-Makdisi conversation.
It's our pleasure to be here tonight to have this conversation, first of all, between ourselves and then opening it up to the rest of you. And I thought we would kick off by just having Miko talk about his book and what drove him to write it and to tell us about, to situate the book, basically, in, first of all, in your own life and then in the world that we live in today. So if you could just fill us into where the book came from, where it fits into the world that we're in, and you know where you think you leave the world having left your book in it, so to speak.
Sure. Well, thank you all for being here, and thank the Levantine Center for putting this together. It's a great event, and the concert that preceded it was wonderful, too. And thank you for coming, Sari. Well, the book, the book basically describes my journey as an Israeli into Palestine. I was born and raised in Jerusalem. I came from a very, very much an establishment family. My grandfather signed the Israeli Declaration of Independence. My father was a career officer and was a general in the Israeli army. And Zionism was part of who I was. And then right around the year 2000, took place. 2007, my sister's little girl was killed in a suicide bombing in Jerusalem. She was 13 years old. And that, of course, shook the whole family and drove many of us into a direction of searching and looking deeper into what is actually happening. What is actually driving this conflict? After she was killed, my sister, her mother, was asked often about revenge and about retaliation and about pointing fingers, and she said, no, I point my finger at the Israeli government who brought these two young men to such despair that they blew themselves up and took my daughter with them. So, of course, this created a whole new kind of life for all of us, including myself. I lived here by then. I was already living in the U.S. And then I began looking, searching, and wondering what it is that I can do. And I was fortunate enough to come across a Jewish-Palestinian dialogue group that was taking place in San Diego at the time. And that's how my journey began, by meeting Palestinians for the very first time in this kind of a setting, like a normal setting where people sit and talk. I was 39 years old. I was living in the United States. And considering I was born and raised in Jerusalem, which is supposedly a mixed city, a united city, which it is. It is a mixed city. It is perhaps a united city, but it's a very segregated city. So Israelis and Palestinians never meet. They have no opportunity to talk to each other, learn about each other. The segregation, in fact, the segregation all over Israel is almost absolute. There's very little room for Israelis and Palestinians to meet. And having taken this journey, I began to learn more and more and travel into Palestine and travel into the West Bank and learn more and more about the Palestinian narrative. And I was able to, at some point, put together a book. I had enough of an experience to put together a book. But also, as I was working on the book, I realized that there were three major issues, three major myths that dominated my point of view and dominated the point of view of Israelis and dominates the point of view of Americans about this issue. And these three myths are the myth of 1948 and what actually took place, how the state of Israel was created. The second myth was the myth of the existential threat that Israel faced supposedly and led Israel to attack and in 1967. And then the myth that Israel is a democracy. And I'll talk more about the myth of the democracy later, but I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the issue of the Palestinian prisoners. You may have heard that today a hunger strike came to an end, where close to 2,000 prisoners were on a hunger strike for close to a month. Several of them have been on a hunger strike for over 70 days. And the prisoners issue is, and I'll talk about it later, and there are two chapters in the book that I dedicate, and quite a few stories that I dedicate in the book to the stories of prisoners. But the importance of the prisoners issue as part of this, of part of Israel's being not being a democracy, and the life that Palestinians lead, and the reality in which Palestinians have to live. But I'll talk about that in just a little bit. But I think it's important to remember that. It's important to take that to mind. Today, it's interesting, I think, that today they chose to, or whoever the powers that be chose to, you know, come to an agreement, knowing that tomorrow is Nakba Day and who knows what else is coming up. I think that, that may have had something to do with their willingness to end the negotiations. But kind of going back to the story chronologically, the first myth, the myth of 1948, is really a very important part of being an Israeli. The story of the few beating the many, the story of David beating Goliath, the story of the Maccabees beating the entire Greek Empire, this is what Israel is all about. And this is what happened supposedly in 1948. There was a small Jewish community that all they wanted to do was live. There was a United Nations resolution that allowed the Israelis to have their own state, the Jews their own state, for the first time in 2,000 years. And here the Arabs come and attack us and try to destroy us. And they were many and we were the few. They were armed and we were not. And yet we prevailed. Because we were smarter and faster and more determined. And this is such a big part of what it means to be an Israeli. That the transformation of moving away from that myth and realizing that it is a myth is unbelievably painful, physically painful. It's like, you know, having a tooth pulled out without anesthesia. I remember the moment when I actually made that transformation in the meetings that I had with the dialogue group, having listened and having listened to Palestinians who went through it themselves. And two things that I talk about in the book and were pivotal in my realization that this is a myth. One is a story that my mother told me many, many, many times throughout my lifetime and finally sunk in. And she was living in Jerusalem. She was born and raised in Jerusalem. She's 85 today. She still lives in Jerusalem. And at one point during the 1948 war, after the Palestinian communities were exiled from West Jerusalem, their homes were given to Israeli families, Jewish families. And she was a young mother. She was 22. She had two young children. My father was in the front fighting, you know, for the Jewish state. He was already a young officer. And she was offered one of these homes. And if you've ever been to Jerusalem, you can see these homes. They're distinct. They're big. They're beautiful. They've got a large yard. I mean, they're a beautiful garden, a beautiful bustan. I mean, they're distinct. And they're still there. And she remembered, as a child, you know, walking through these neighborhoods on a weekend and seeing the families sitting outside and so on. And when she was offered one of these homes, she could not bring herself to take it. She said, that I would take the home of another mother, of another family, who is now in a refugee camp and must be missing their home and missing their country? She was 22 years old, you know, no mortgage, no nothing, a free home, just like that. And she said, no. And I remember her telling me the story many, many times. So that was one story that was in the back of my mind the whole time, which kind of didn't fit really with the bigger story, with a bigger narrative, with a myth. The other part of it is when you look at it historically, from the day of the United Nations resolution to partition Palestine, November 29, 1947, till, you know, the end of 1948, December 1948, that 12-month period, that one-year period, when we look at what took place, the Israeli forces, the Zionist forces, conquered almost the entire country, 80% of the country. They exiled somewhere between 800,000 and 1 million civilians, forced exiled. And they destroyed somewhere around 500 towns and villages. Some of these towns were, you know, 1,000 years old. If they were the ones being attacked, how did they do this? Where did they have the resources to do this? You'd think they'd fight a defensive war. How was this accomplished? And when you look at that time frame and you start looking back and trying to think and trying to study what actually took place, you realize that the myth is a myth. The state of Israel was in fact created on the ruins of another country, on the ruins of another nation, through looting, through forced exile, through massacres. And this is a tough, tough realization when your whole life you've been brought up to believe that Zionism was a good thing and the state of Israel was a good thing, and we are always morally right and righteous. So that was one of those. That's one pivotal realization that came to me through, and it wasn't instantaneous. This took a long time of reading and studying and listening to people and listening to the same old story again and again and again and again. And every time I tell this story about my mother, there's a Palestinian in the crowd who comes and tells me about his family or her family's home in Katamon or some other Jerusalem neighborhood. Now moving forward to 1967, 20 years later, and again, what is the story that people talk about here and people talk about in Israel? Once again, the small Jewish state, having finally established itself, was attacked by three Arab armies determined to destroy it and throw the Jews into the sea. And yet, miraculously, the small Jewish nation, the small Jewish army, was able not only to defeat and destroy three Arab armies, but triple the size of Israel. Take the West Bank, take the Golan Heights, and take the Sinai Peninsula and the Gaza Strip. Miraculous. Now, my father was a general during that time, and he was one of the generals that planned and prepared the Israeli army and executed this war. And in my research for the book, one of the things I decided to do was go into the Israeli army archives and take a look and see what they had to offer, to read about his career. And it was a long career, so there was a lot to read. But what I really wanted to see was the minutes of the meetings leading up to the 1967 war. And a lot has been written. There's several books about that period, the period leading up to the war. There are several documentaries about what took place. But I thought, I want to see it for myself. There's something pretty special where you see your dad's name and then the stuff that took place, and it's this wonderfully historical moment. So I took a lot of pleasure in actually seeing it and reading it. But what was very interesting, and the one thing that I saw in those minutes that I didn't see in any book, or any documentary that I've seen, is a very simple statement that he made and several of the other generals had made. Now, if you recall, the issue was President Nasser decided to kick out the UN peacekeeping force from the Sinai Peninsula and entered his forces into Sinai, which was supposed to be demilitarized, and he threatened to close the Straits of Tiran to Israeli boats going up to Eilat. Well, these were all acts that, almost like a declaration, these were a declaration of war, in fact. And the generals took this opportunity and said, we have an opportunity now to destroy the Egyptian army because the Egyptian army is not prepared for war. And they say this in their meetings over and over again. The Egyptian army needs at least a year and a half to 2 years in order to be prepared for war. By doing all these things, they actually put themselves in danger. Let's take this opportunity and destroy the Egyptian army. And an interesting thing took place there because the Israeli cabinet was opposed to war. And the generals were pushing for war. And when you look at these two power centers in Israel, it's very interesting. The cabinet members were all but one, were older, in their mid-60s. They were born in exile, Eastern Europe. They remembered the pogroms and they remembered the persecution of Jews and they carried all of this. And this, mind you, this is 1967, 25 years after the Holocaust, not even. And they were scared. And the Israeli people were scared. They thought the Arabs were coming to destroy us like the Nazis did, because that's what everybody does to Jews. This was their perspective. And the generals were saying, no, 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 what are you talking about? How can you not trust us? We defeated every single army we ever fought. And they demanded, and my father spoke in very harsh words to the prime minister. There was this one particular meeting where they all met, where the cabinet came to the army headquarters, which is interesting. They came to the army headquarters. And the generals were young, they were in their early 40s to mid-40s, most of them were born in Israel, they were strong, and they were this new Jew, so to speak, you know. They were strong, they were going to fight back, they were assertive, and they had an opportunity here. And this tug of war began between these two groups, and of course the generals won the day, and the cabinet approved a preemptive strike against Egypt. Now, as you look at the history of the development of Israel and the development of the army and the relationships between the army and the elected government, it's very interesting. But one thing is clear. Everybody wanted the West Bank and everybody wanted the Golan Heights for many, many years. These were areas that Israel coveted all the time. They were rich with water and they were rich with good land and so on and so forth. So once the Egyptian army was destroyed in a matter of a couple of days, then the generals decided to take the West Bank and decided to take the Golan Heights, and they did. And in 6 days, it was over. Once again, the small state was attacked by three massive armies intending to destroy it, and in 6 days decimated three armies and tripled the size of the country. But having looked at the army archives, this one very simple statement that they made over and over again kind of clarifies things. The Egyptian army was not prepared for war. This was an opportunity to destroy them. So they went into this war knowing full well they were going to win, fully intending to take the land. And another interesting statistic is that in those 6 days, the number of casualties the Arab army suffered is about 15,000. That's 15,000 casualties in 6 days. That's a lot of dead people. The Israeli army suffered 700 casualties. It's a ratio that's not even it's impossible to comprehend. And once again, this myth is just completely, you know, diffused when you look at the facts, when you actually sit down and read and see what took place. And then you realize that this is exactly what the generals wanted. So that was yet another myth that was dispelled as I was working on the book. And then the myth of the Israeli democracy, that was also a very, very difficult one. Because, you know, we're a democracy, and, you know, yes, we may be occupiers and so on and so forth, but we're good occupiers. We're benevolent. We're not like others. And as I began to meet more Palestinians, and as I began to really take a closer look at the life of Palestinians in Israel, whether they're Israeli citizens or not, what comes through is a very clear picture of an apartheid state. And the reason I use the word apartheid is because they govern different populations with different laws. So if you're an Israeli Jew, you're a VIP. You live in a democracy. You can come and go. You can speak your mind. You can do what you want. If you're an Israeli citizen, but you're a Palestinian, then there are, besides there being a whole culture of discrimination, there are also over 20 laws in the law books that discriminate against Palestinians who are Israeli citizens. And then the culture is very deep. The culture is things like a Palestinian couple, for example, Israeli citizens, can't get a mortgage, for example. You know, it's things that are essential to being able to live a normal daily life. And then, of course, Palestinians in the West Bank of Gaza, there is no law that protects them. They are completely they live at the pleasure of the Israeli army, the Israeli defense forces, and the Israeli security forces. So if you've got three different populations being governed by three different sets of laws, number one, it's obvious that it's all one state, because everybody's being governed by the same government. So this whole notion that somehow it's not really all one state, or one state, two state, this whole thing, we'll talk about that later, but already right at the get-go you can see that there's one state, everybody's being governed by the same government, albeit under three different sets of laws. And then what the Israeli government was very good at creating, besides the wonderful PR machine that chose Israel as this wonderful democracy, is an internal system that allows this to function. One of the questions that comes up a lot is, how is it the Israeli soldiers can be such monsters? I mean, you look at young Israelis, they look like nice, normal people who grew up in normal Western societies. What is it when they put the uniform and they're placed in the West Bank, they become monsters? How do they do this? Well, Israel developed an education system that is an inherently racist education system. And there's a book that just came out by my sister, who's an educator, who teaches at the Hebrew University, about how Palestinians are portrayed in Israeli textbooks. And it shows the textbook racism by which the Israeli education system works. Textbook racism. So obviously, when you're 18, you've been prepared for this, now you're given a gun, and these are the people that you were raised to hate. And I won't get into that, but there's a lot. Like I said, it's a very big book that she wrote. It's a very interesting book, too. And then you've got the Israeli military, who has one function, and that is to kill and destroy and make life of Palestinians hell. Whether it's bombing Gaza, dropping hundreds of tons of bombs on a civilian population, whether it's shooting peaceful protesters, whether it's going into people's homes and arresting them in the middle of the night. This is what the Israeli army does. It's an army. I think better than describing it as an army, I think it's better described as probably one of the best fed, best funded, best armed terrorist organizations in the world. Probably not the biggest one, but one of the biggest ones. Because its sole function is to terrorize. And then the third arm is the bureaucracy. And Sari's book, Palestine Inside Out, describes the bureaucracy. The laws and restrictions, and the restrictions and the permits, and the permits of restrictions. There's an Israeli human rights attorney called Michal Sfard who describes it as mountains of permits and oceans of restrictions. This is the life of Palestinians. And with these three branches, they have created this perfect system that works very, very well. So once again, the third myth, like I said, the third myth is this myth of the Israeli democracy. And now, as I travel, as I go to Israel, which I do quite a lot, it's obvious. You know, you see it as you go from place to place. And I had an interesting experience. One of the characteristics of the apartheid is that if I break the law and a Palestinian breaks the law and we're exactly in the same place, two different laws apply to us as in terms of how the law treats our the fact that we violated the law. So I was at a protest in the West Bank. You know, there's all these protests every Friday, every Saturday in the West Bank, peaceful protests. And you show up at one of these protests, if you've ever seen one, there's maybe 20, 30, 50 peaceniks marching. You know, half of them are Palestinians and half of them are Israelis and foreign, you know, internationals. And then the army shows up and it's like, you know, you'll have 50 protesters and 200 fully armed soldiers. It's insane. Anyway, I was arrested and the soldiers handed me over to the civilian police. And when they took me to the police station, the police chief, the station chief wouldn't take me. He said, I need the arresting officer to come and sign a statement. And he didn't want to come. He didn't come. Anyway, these two branches were starting to argue. And phones and faxes, and they're yelling at each other. And I'm sitting there watching the whole thing. And this is going on for hours and hours. I was there the entire day. And the two soldiers that had me couldn't figure out what was going on. Why was the police station chief making so much problem? Why won't he just take me? Finally, towards the end, he came out and he said to them, look, you don't understand. He's an Israeli citizen. He has rights. He's not a Palestinian that I can just beat up and throw in jail. You know? So it's very clear. It's not something people don't know. It's not something that's out there. People know it. People live it every single day. You know? And then, and like I said, I talk a lot about the prison system, which is part of that bureaucracy. You know, thousands and thousands of Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails in violation of international law. Many of them held without trial. As we know, this is what prompted the hunger strikes. Over 90% of them are not held for violent crimes. Over 90% of them are not held for violent crimes. We're not charged with violent crimes. We're talking about thousands of people. I read somewhere that they say the Palestinians are some of the are the most incarcerated people in the world. And I talk about that in the book a lot because that's an important part of this whole picture. And then I end the book with my conclusion. You know, as you take a look back, as I take a look back, and again we'll talk. Sorry, and I will talk about that a little bit later again, some more. But as I take a look back, I see this one state, clearly one state being governed. All 10 million people or so being governed by one government under different laws. A solution whereby we partition and chop and segregate is not going to work. It's not going to work. Billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars have been invested to make that not possible. So what would be more natural than to take a country that is not a democracy and work toward a transformation to make it a democracy, an inclusive, secular, pluralistic democracy, which is my own personal conclusion. And I'll end just by saying this. If we look at the future, if we look at kids that are being born there, parents, young parents who are raising their kids there, what could be more natural than for them to learn about each other, to learn the different each other's languages, to appreciate each other's culture, and to know that they all share this place, which they do anyway. And then to envision this very bright future that they can create for themselves. But we have to be willing to believe that it's possible. You know, I gave a talk to a bunch of eighth graders about a month ago, and they were studying about this. And among themselves, they took a little poll to see how many of them thought peace was possible in their lifetime. And 80%, these are eighth graders, they're 13 years old, 80% thought peace was not possible in their lifetime between Israelis and Palestinians. So that's got to change. But I personally think that if we do follow that route, if we do follow that path, then there's a very, very, very good possibility that these kids will have a bright future. Anyway, thank you. That's what the book's about.
So there are a lot of things I want to ask, but let me begin with, there's two questions that are in my mind, and I'll ask them both, and then you can take them as you want. The first question is, hearing what you say now, what you just said, which to me is, you know, laying out the sort of bare bones, very clear terms, what the reality on the ground is, what the history has been, and hence what the possible futures are, and which is the preferable future for, you know, democracy and rights and justice and that kind of thing. It's incredibly clear, incredibly lucid, and I think we completely agree. The question is, so one question is, why is it so difficult, why does it seem so difficult sometimes, to get that point across, especially in the U.S. I think it's actually becoming easier, and I want to ask you whether you've noticed the change in the past 2 years. I think it's getting easier, but it has certainly been difficult. I mean, we know if you go down the street, down Robertson Avenue or Boulevard, down to Pico, there's an organization down there called the Museum of Tolerance that I'm sure you know about.
Yes.
That has spent, I don't know how, the past several years quickly, in the middle of the night, excavating graves in a Muslim cemetery in Jerusalem, and they want to build a clone of their Museum of Tolerance on the ruins of the cemetery, which strikes me as an extraordinary kind of thing. And I've tangled with them a couple of times in different print forums, in the LA Times and otherwise. And, you know, my point is, can you not see that there's something fundamentally wrong here? And they protest. They don't see anything wrong with it. And the thing is, I actually believe that they don't see anything wrong. In other words, I don't think that they're hedging. I think they really... I think they fundamentally don't get it at some level. So can you take us, you know, briefly into a detour of that mode to explain to us how could somebody see the same reality that we're seeing but yet not see it, right? That's one question I want to ask you. And the second question I want to ask you, and it's kind of the flip side of that question, is you begin your book by talking about the bombing that killed your niece, which I can imagine was a horribly traumatic, you know, personal kind of family experience, awful in a human sense, in the abstract, but even more when it's your family, it's affected like that. And I could easily imagine it being the kind of experience that could have pushed you in a very different kind of direction, politically, morally, and philosophically. And yet it had this kind of awakening effect on you and on other members of your family. So you can see these two questions. I mean, how do we put together this sort of willful ignorance on the one hand with, on the other hand, the quest for knowledge and truth and justice that you've yourself embarked on?
Yeah, well, you asked the two very difficult questions. I'll start with the second one.
Okay.
Because it's a little more personal, so I think I have more access to the answers. I think part of it goes back to that story my mother told us all about how she couldn't take the home of a Palestinian, which immediately placed the Palestinians on a human level equal to us. And that's not the narrative, that's not the message Israelis get. And that's not the message that a lot of people, not only Jewish people, but certainly Jewish people, mainstream Jewish community, and a lot of Americans get. And perhaps that kind of talks about the other question. Because if we're equal, if we treat each other as equals, if we treat each other fairly, if we treat each other as humans, then that puts everything in a different perspective right off the bat. The second thing is, when my father's career was an interesting one, and I won't get all into it, but one of the stations in his career was he was the military governor of Gaza after the 1956 Sinai War. And the way that war was justified was there were all these refugees sitting there just waiting to come and get us because we took their land. Never mind the fact, Palestinians never had an army. Okay? Never had a fighter jet or a boat or a tank or anything. But they're out there and they're going to come and kill us, even though we already have this big army. This is what justified the war. This is why Ben-Gurion and Moshe Dayan pushed for that war, which also ended in 5 days. But he was face to face with these people. And his impression was, later on, these people weren't out to kill anybody. They weren't out for revenge. They weren't out for blood. They were out, they just wanted to live their lives and somehow get along so we can all move beyond this. This is 1957. When the 1967 war was over, massive victory. For the first time, these generals, these young Israeli generals, for the very first time, okay, made it possible for the Jewish people to control the entire land of Israel after 2,000 years. Can you imagine the magnitude of their glory? And here they were sitting at the very first meeting of the general staff, the army general staff, after the war. And my father said this, and it's in the book and it's in the archives. He said, this is the very first time, this is an opportunity for us to finally solve the Palestinian problem. For the very first time, we're sitting face to face with the Palestinians. No other Arab armies or countries between us. And we have an opportunity to solve this problem by allowing them to create a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. This is a week after the war was over. Everybody thought he lost his mind. We just conquered all this land. We own it. This is ours, Bethlehem and Hebron and Shiloh, all these biblical names. And you want to do what? He said, if we don't do this, if we govern these people against their will, they will resist. The Israeli army will be forced to quell the resistance. The Israeli army will become an army of occupation with disastrous moral results, moral outcomes for us as a society and for the army. And there's not going to be an end to it, other than creating a state in which the Jews are no longer a majority and there won't be a Jewish state. These are the options. We either allow them a state right now. He saw it as it was a major strategic point that Israel should not govern millions of Palestinians, because otherwise there won't be a Jewish state. And having a Jewish state was the whole point of this whole Zionism thing, right? But of course, nobody listened. But from that moment on, he dedicated the rest of his life to accomplishing that, to accomplishing a just solution for the Palestinian, for the Palestinians within that framework of the two-state solution. And those were the years the two-state solution was formed. And after he retired a year later, he began to be an advocate for Palestinian rights, both Israeli citizens and Palestinians in the West Bank. And people all to this day come to me. I mean, Israelis don't remember his name, but Palestinians all remember his name. There's not a time that I go into the West Bank or I go into the Galilee and I talk to people, especially if they're a little bit older, and they remind me of something that he did for them or their son, or that he helped them to get a permit to go, to do the simple things that they're not allowed to do, or, I mean, all these different things, get them out of jail, all these different things. He became an advocate. He dedicated the rest of his life to this cause. And once again, that meant the Palestinians were on par. That means we were equal. That means they deserved what we deserve. That means that this double standard is not right. So that was the backdrop. That was how I was raised. On the one hand, there was this great sense of Zionism and patriotism. On the other hand, the sense that the Palestinians were equals and we need to resolve this. And when the tragedy took place, I mean, my sister led this. I mean, we were all in shock still. My dad had passed away 2 years earlier, so he was spared this. But, the day of the funeral, because she was the granddaughter of a general, a famous general, plus the granddaughter not only of a general, but a general who became a peace man. And he was Mr. Peace with Palestinians, and look what they did to him. You know, this was the point of view. When she came out of her room the next day after the funeral to meet the endless number of reporters and people who came to express their sorrow and so on, and she was asked about, you know, retaliation, she said, made a very, very simple statement. She said, no real mother would want the same thing to happen to another mother. Nothing to do with Palestinians, nothing to do with Jews, nothing to do with Israelis. This is a human thing. Motherhood is something that unites us. Of course, this created even more news. So this was where she came from, and she led this, and then she and her husband joined an organization called the Bereaved Families Forum, which is an incredibly, incredibly inspiring group of people, Israelis and Palestinians. We'll reach out and speak to each other and create possibilities to create reconciliation, I should say. And so this is what drove, you know, these were all the different steps that led me to, you know, doing what I'm doing. But that was the backdrop. That was how it was possible. But I think, and the way this connects to your other question is, Israelis don't learn this. Israelis don't know the Palestinians don't have an army, that they've never had an army. When Israel bombed Gaza at the end of 2008, they began the attack December 27th, 2008, 11:25 in the morning, by dropping 100 tons of bombs on Gaza. On the first day of a 21-day attack. On the first day of a 21-day attack. Now, I don't know if you know this, a one-ton bomb will destroy a city block. If you know anything about Gaza, you know that it's a highly dense, very densely populated place. It's very small. 100 tons of bombs from the air. There's no army in Gaza. There is no military force in Gaza. There are no tanks, planes, artillery batteries, nothing. Who are they killing? But that thought never even comes to the place in their mind where they can even think about it or digest it. And this was the air assault. After that was over, the ground forces came in. And I don't know if you saw pictures, but you see rows and rows and rows of tanks preparing to enter Gaza. To do what? What is this, World War II? The Russian army is there? I mean, there's nothing there. Yet Israelis don't even think about this in those terms because this is the education system. This is the success of the Zionist education system. It's such that it can bring people to do these things and think nothing of it. And I think this Zionist education, I think one of the biggest mistakes that the mainstream Jewish communities in America did was they bought into Zionism and they became Zionist. Because it corrupted them. And it took away their Jewishness. And they have the same point of view. They see the exact same thing and they think it's okay. It's okay. Who cares about, you know, 1,000 years of Muslim history? This is our country. We need to get rid of this 1,000 years of Muslim history so that we can create a connection between the mythological kingdom of Israel that's as it's written in the Old Testament, and today Zionism. Look at Silwan, you know, this neighborhood outside Jerusalem. If you've ever been to Silwan, it's just down from the old city, right? So you see Silwan, and up here is the Jewish quarter. And they're destroying it because somebody said that King David's true city was under the homes of the 50,000 residents. Never mind, nobody even knows King David even existed historically. There is no proof. But I mean, this is the point of view. Yeah. You know, they don't exist, they're not important.
But there are obviously exceptions to the rule, both here in the U.S. and the Jewish communities in the U.S. and obviously in Israel too. So is it just fluke? Is it personal circumstances? Who your parents were? Is that what enables people to break through these kind of, you know, mindsets that would otherwise trap them? Or, I mean, is that, do we have to hope, in other words, for those kinds of circumstances? Or can we imagine outreach programs like this, or writing, or making other kinds of public interventions to also make a difference in people's minds? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I think both things are true. I think on the one hand, this is the big question. You know, what forms people's opinion and their ability to reach out and see what unites us as opposed to what divides us, which is really the question. A lot of times it's personal experience. A lot of times it's who your parents were. A lot of times it could be all these little flukes. At the same time, educating and writing and having events like this and having a Levantine Center and all these kinds of things have to be part of that, because more and more people, I think it's inevitable eventually that the Jewish community will come around. You know, I don't think, you know, Jewish people in general, it's, you know, you don't want to characterize too much a stereotype, but this is a good stereotype. They always stand for, you know, throughout history, they stood for good things, for positive things, for positive change, for human rights, for the poor, for the, you know. And now, as looking at Israel, you hear is like the poor suddenly succeeding. It's not going to be very, take very, I think eventually they're going to look at this thing and they say, well, this is not the baby we wanted. You know, we've got to change this, and then things will change. And I think this is a big part of that.
So have you noticed in your own kind of outreach, your own, when you give talks, or after your book, now that your book is out, you've written articles and that kind of thing, have you noticed any kind of change taking place in the U.S. in the past 2 years in terms of public opinion or attitudes around these kinds of questions?
Well, I think I see a lot more opportunities to talk about it, number one. I see that there's a lot of growth. If you look at, you know, one example, if you look at Palestine Solidarity Week, which began seven years ago, with just a couple of colleges holding week-long events or maybe bringing out a speaker. I think this year there were 100 or so, 120 different colleges, universities. I know I spoke at three during that week, and some of them were in Canada. I mean, they're everywhere. There's an aware, and these are important because people are listening and people are becoming aware. So there's a lot more talk about this. People are becoming more aware, more sensitive to this. You know, the BDS, the boycott, divestment, sanctions against Israel is growing, and people are beginning to look at it in terms of, you know, maybe there's something to it. You know, I think this whole prisoners thing is going to bring is shedding a new light. I mean, CNN did a couple of reports on this. I heard another report on the news coming up on public radio. I mean, suddenly more and more people are talking about these things. So there's definitely a change in that, you know. And how deep it is in terms of getting into the Jewish community, getting into actually making change, it's hard to see yet. But there's definitely a lot more discussion.
Yeah, I remember, I mean, when I first started doing this kind of thing in college, which was a long time ago, relatively speaking, it was. I mean, I remember, you know, saying things like saying the word Palestine was a very, very big deal back in the 80s. And now it's sort of common. You know, even the White House talks about a Palestinian state, at least theoretically. So I think, you know, things have shifted a lot in the past several years. I know the audience, I'm sure, is keen to ask questions. Let me just ask one more question, which is about one state and two states and three states or no state. And I mean, I think we both advocate a one-state, democratic and secular state to end this conflict, to create a situation where both peoples could live as equals in a shared territory. That's, I think, something that's also been gaining, that idea has been gaining ground recently, too. Do you think it's also been gaining ground?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. Absolutely. It's interesting, when I talk in front of very conservative audiences, often they're quite clueless about the issue, but they're conservative about it because it's kind of they're pro-Israel because that's what you do. And when I talk about the possibility of equal rights, they say, well, how come we haven't heard about this yet? This is kind of like actually a pretty good idea. You know, this is kind of what America is like, you know. But definitely more and more people are talking about it. I think more and more people are talking about it in Palestine itself, which is important. In Israel, it's still taboo. I mean, more and more people on the very fringe talk about it, but it's taboo. It's treasonous. Anything that's anti-Zionist is treason in Israel still. But on the Palestinian side, people that I talk to all the time, and here, and there's a lot more discussion, realizing two states is, you know, it's done. It's not going to happen. And therefore, a secular democracy is really the only option. And so definitely, I think it's growing, and I think it's inevitable that it's going to grow because it is the only solution.
That is the reality on the ground.
I mean, that is the reality on the ground.
But did you see the editorial in the LA Times last week about one state and two state?
No, I didn't. I heard about it, but I missed it.
They had an editorial, not an op-ed, an editorial, because there's some congressman whose name escapes me who wrote an article recently saying that Israel basically should, that it, there is effectively one state, and Israel should actualize this one state and basically tell the Palestinians in the occupied territories either go or accept your permanent sort of disenfranchisement. And the LA Times editorial basically said, "We, you know, they still believe, they're still holding out for the two-state, there's still hope for two-state solution." And it's always struck me as kind of incredible that, you know, we've been talking about two-state solution for literally 20 years now, and we're not closer to two-state, we're actually much further than any we've ever been.
True.
But there's just still this refrain keeps coming up, let's go back to two states. I mean, yeah, it seems to me that that's kind of clutching at straws in some kind of way. But I'm sure the audience would like to intervene at this point.
I have a microphone here, so maybe we can just take turns, and please try to keep your questions or comments brief.
Yeah.
And say, you had your hand up first, and then you...
Two things really briefly. One is mentioning a group called One Voice that was just here. Three young women, one American, one Palestinian, one Israeli. And among the Israeli was saying how she grew up with always feeling under threat. And the Palestinian young woman from Jerusalem said that the greatest, also living under this incredible pressure, the greatest liberation that she experienced, and my heart just almost broke, was when she was able to learn some Hebrew so she could walk across the street and order a coffee like anyone else, or tell a guard at a post that she had to go to the bathroom in a way that he would understand. And it was just like inconceivable, and no knowledge of why Israel was there. What is this thing, Israel? What does it mean to be Jewish? Why is the whole of Israel closed on Saturdays? What's this all about? It's like the level of human ignorance that the people are kept under was just, it was appalling to me, because here we are in the political, delusional, you know, the whole scheme, and not realizing what's going on in the human level. And my question, if I may, is, which is so apparent, is the role that, because we see it so strongly, of the extreme right-wing Christian military in America and the Zionist agenda, and how this, the one and the other are reinforcing each other to the point of this arrogant toleration of this inhumanity.
So the question is you're talking about the connection between the Christian Zionists and the Zionists in Israel, basically.
Yeah.
It's funny, I gave a talk about my book a couple of weeks ago in San Diego, and I got an email from an elderly couple who came in, and they asked me, we like your talk, and we didn't agree with everything, and we have a couple of questions. And one question is, are you Jewish or are you Christian? And then they don't agree with me about my conclusion, because according to the history that's in the Bible, peace will never come to that region. I mean, where do you start? First of all, the Bible has got nothing to do with history. That's first of all. I mean, you can be a religious believer and so on and so forth, but I think most people, you know, so the Bible and the history. And number two, where does it say in the Bible that there can never be peace there? I mean, what are they even talking about? But there are all these myths that are out there that are completely swallowed whole and accepted whole without giving them even a moment's thought. You know, and I was talking to an associate of mine who's a very intelligent, educated American, happens to be a Republican. But what are you going to do? And she said, "Well, yeah, I mean, this conflict has been going on forever, and there is no hope." I said, "What are you talking about? 1,500 years of Islamic rule in the Middle East were mostly peaceful, were mostly very tolerant." You know, Zionism and the West brought all this, all the divisions and the separation, the segregation, and the problems that we face today. This is not some kind of act of God. This is not some kind of a destiny that we're all forced to live with. This was created by, there's a great quote by Nelson Mandela that apartheid was created by man, and therefore it can be solved by man. It's not an act of God. This is the same thing, you know. But there are all these myths out there that nobody bothers to think about. And so that's why they feed off each other.
As I was listening, I thought suddenly appeared in my head whether, if people knew Afrikaners prior to Mandela being released, whether there wouldn't have been the sense of the same, it will absolutely never occur. I don't know.
I think there was a sense that it would never occur.
Oh, there was definitely a sense of Africa. Right?
The Afrikaners said, we're never giving it up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So maybe
no, there's no question
change
that
is possible.
Changes. I think we both share that philosophy very clearly. That, and it's not just a sort of philosophical position; it really is a historical position too. I mean, if you had told somebody in South Africa, in the say mid 1980s, in a few years, not only would Nelson Mandela be out of jail, but he's going to be the president of the republic, and there won't be apartheid, they would have said, "You're dreaming. You're insane, right? Not just dreaming." And look what happened. I mean, so I think it's inevitably the case that in cases like that, or the Soviet Union falling, or in this case too, when change happens, it happens very, very, very suddenly, and nobody ever sees it coming in a way. And the poet that I work on the most, an English poet called William Blake, once said that the history of all times and places is nothing else but improbabilities and impossibilities. What we should say was impossible if we did not see it always before our eyes. This miraculous, history is kind of miraculous if you think about it. The kinds of things that happen, we never see them coming in a way, and yet they always come anyway. So I have, you know, I think it's clear that this is a situation that's like that situation, without sort of descending into sort of a faith-based kind of, you know, let's hope this is inevitable. Nothing is inevitable. We have to make it happen. But the fact that it seems difficult doesn't mean that it can't happen either. And I mean, to go back to the previous question, I think it's true that there are clearly people who think along those lines. And, you know, what can one say at the end of the day, except that there are many more people who don't think like that, I hope. So I think one has to have faith in, you know, sort of ordinary people, too, who are capable of changing and learning and developing and transforming. And I think that was the case in South Africa, too.
I'm one of those, by the way, that was in the middle of the night, the Israeli army came to the house and kicked me out. So just one true example of what happens. I said I'm one of the ones that he talked about where in the middle of the night the Israeli army would go in and take you out of your home and throw you over the bridge because you were not counted in the census, so you couldn't live with your parents. So one of them. My question actually is, you said there's no army and there's no military in Gaza, yet we call them, we bundle them up with the terrorist groups. And of course, this is thanks to Osama bin Laden, where Israel and America and everybody else can group anybody they want to call them terrorist groups. So how can we call Hamas, which I don't know about, you know, who is right or who's wrong, but how do we call Hamas a terrorist group where actually there's no army?
You know, if you tell a lie enough time, people begin to believe it. You know, if you tell people a lie enough times, they believe it. The question, it's a fair question, because people, a question that comes up often after I say these things, they'll say, yeah, but what about the Qassam rockets? And my wife's family lives in a small town, it's a kibbutz, kind of like agricultural community, just north of Gaza. And they suffered a lot of Qassam rockets flying all over the place. And we were there several times with the kids, and the Qassam rockets go all over the place. And let me tell you, it's not pleasant. These rockets fly over, and you don't know where they're going to land, and they've got this shriek, and there's the alarm system goes off, and all this kind of stuff. And I was there once, and the day before that, or just before that, most of the Qassam rockets fall in the middle of nowhere, so nobody gets hurt. I think the only one time that somebody actually got hurt, they fell on an army base not far from there, which is probably a fluke, and a soldier was killed. But anyway, I was there one day, right after a Qassam rocket fell, right next to the kindergarten, and there were kids there. So there was broken glass and blood, and kids were panicking and screaming and so on. And you could see on the ground, you could see this hole in the ground where the rocket fell. And yeah, it's terrible. But you take this hole in the ground, and the fact that a few kids were, scratched and, scared, which is terrible, of course. And then you look at a hole in the ground made by a one-ton bomb, and you multiply that by 100, another 100, another 100, another 100, and you go, excuse me, are we out of our minds? Does anybody sincerely expect, that you can keep an entire population in a prison like Gaza, and there will be zero violence? There will be absolutely no violent response at all? Is this even a realistic, a remotely realistic expectation? So number one, I think the surprise is that there isn't more of that. Not that there's, but when you compare that to the devastation of the Israeli terrorist army, because that's what the Israeli army is, the terror that the Israeli army brings upon the Palestinians is it. And it's terrible to say, but it makes this little poor little hole in the ground seem like, it's nothing.
Firecracker.
Certainly they're both unpleasant. Certainly they're both bad. But, I mean, can you really expect, does anybody have an expectation that people will live under these conditions, closed in a ghetto like this, in a concentration camp like this, and not resort to some sort of violent resistance?
Yeah, but again, I take that point, of course, but the amazing thing is that to this day, here in the U.S. in particular, one hears endlessly about the rockets falling on Sderot and the rockets falling, right. And yet there's no, and how many tens of thousands of whatever. And of course, it's true that 99% of them end up in fields, thankfully, they don't hurt anybody. But nobody knows the tonnage or the number of rockets.
They ignore it. They completely ignore it. And they don't realize, and they forget the fact that there is no army in Gaza. These are a bunch of kids with a rocket that they made themselves, pretty much,
We got to give everybody a turn. So, was there somebody here? I think, and then there.
Well, I have a question about why a two-state won't work. And one thing you said, I thought I understood you to say, if there's one state, it won't be a Jewish state. So I don't see that would be possible from the Jewish point of view, and you're saying a two-state won't work. So where are we going?
Well, there are many reasons why it won't work. The basic premise of Zionism is that it's a zero-sum game on the issue of the land. There can be no compromise. That's why I tell people there cannot be a solution where a Zionist government is a party to it, because the Zionists will never part with any part of the land of Israel. The land of Israel belongs to the Jewish people. The Israeli government is the protector of that. End of story. The entire land of Israel. Yes, we might have to compromise, so we give them a city here with a little autonomy and a city there with a little autonomy just so they shut up. That's it. That is the most Palestinians can ever expect from a Zionist Israeli government. Now that's the kind of the historical, philosophical, point of view. From a practical point of view, if you look at the West Bank, over the years that Israel has governed the West Bank, billions upon billions of dollars have been invested in the West Bank to build cities and roads and whatnot. And we're not talking about little settlements, little farms. We're talking about major cities We're talking about major highways and malls and schools. Not a dime, not a single dime was for Palestinians, who are the majority in the West Bank. Not a dime. All of it is to bring Israeli Jews into the West Bank and to create the wall between them and to protect them. Not a dime. When you look at the water distribution, okay? The water distribution, one of the biggest water reservoirs is in the West Bank, which is why Israel wanted to take the West Bank to begin with. Okay? The Israeli Water Authority controls all of the water and distributes it. Israelis get 300 cubic meters of water per year. Palestinians in the West Bank get somewhere between 30 and 80 cubic meters of water per year. Now, a lot of the water comes from the West Bank. The Israeli settlers who live in the West Bank get 1,500 cubic meters of water per year. So you have these major towns with tiled roofs and lawns and swimming pools 500 meters from a Palestinian town where there's no water. Besides that, Israel closes the water supply for the Palestinians from time to time, just closes it. So there is no water supply. So you've got the practicality of the development for Israelis in the West Bank, although it's very segregated, but it's very mixed. You've got Israeli settlements all over the place, and you've got the unwillingness to begin with of Zionism as a movement, as a political movement, to never compromise on the issue of the land. Now people say, oh, Rabin was willing to make peace with Arafat and all that. Even the most moderate Zionist government was not willing to compromise on what is called the expanded Jerusalem, which is about 25% of the West Bank now. The entire Jordan River Valley, which is a third of the West Bank. And the major settlements blocks, which are another about 20% of the West Bank, with some extension and room to grow. And this is the most moderate Israeli Zionist government. So, by definition, a two-state solution where Israel is one of the parties, a Zionist Israel is one of the parties to this, is impossible.
But there, I mean, to that I would also add that the point that Miko's making is that there's physically no longer room for a Palestinian state, even if there once was or might have been. Literally, the space in which such a state might have been built is no longer there. I mean, it's been taken over exclusively for Israeli use, to the point where there's 600,000 settlers who would have to be displaced in order to even think about creating a Palestinian state, not to mention water and electricity and roads and airspace and all that. But then on top of that, only a minority of Palestinians live in the occupied territories. So the single largest group of Palestinians are those in exile who have a right to return home. And the two-state solution has not only nothing to say about those people's rights, but in fact endangers it all the more. So that's a very problematic thing from a Palestinian perspective. And finally, there are the Palestinians that Miko talked about who are citizens of the State of Israel, who currently live under massive forms of disenfranchisement and inequality and being excluded from access to land and resources like money and education and so forth, who again, their rights are not only not addressed in a two-state framework, but in fact, they'd be in a much worse situation, I think, with a two-state solution than they already are now. And they make up about roughly 20% of Israel's population within its pre-67 borders. So no matter how you slice and dice the two-state solution, there's no way to address the fundamental rights of the vast majority of Palestinians. They would be excluded from this kind of settlement. And even if you could somehow create a workable Palestinian state, it's just, by excluding most Palestinians, that's not going to be a solution ultimately. So that,
yeah, and I'll say another thing, because when you say this, especially if you're talking to a Jew, I hate to bring up Jews all the time, but mainstream Jewish people are very Zionist. One of the things they come back with, yes, but Israel was willing to give them this, and Israel was willing to give them that, and Israel made all these concessions, and Palestinians are not willing to ever make concessions, and that's why Oslo fell apart, and that's why Camp David fell apart. And people, I think it's important to take into account one more thing, in light of what Sari just said. Remember that, because that's an important, a crucial point. In light of all that, okay? Yasser Arafat, during the 70s, and then the 80s, and then the 90s, and until he died in 2004, was willing to make peace with Israel based on the two-state solution. Meaning that the entire West Bank, including East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip, would be that Palestinian state. Okay? That in itself can you imagine how much they gave up? They gave up 80% by doing that. It's a concession of unimaginable proportions. He was willing to give up 80% of Palestine and the rights of Palestinians in exile to return, just to move on and to make peace. Whether or not it was a workable solution, who knew? You know, that's another discussion. But he was willing to do that. When they wanted him to compromise more, to concede more, to give up the Jordan River Valley, to give up East Jerusalem, to give up the settlement blocks, that he was not willing to do, and he was vilified, and he was, you know, and he died in, you know, with Israeli tanks around him, under siege. But this argument that Palestinians were not willing to make concessions is such a big lie. You know, and all you have to do is take a look at what the two-state solution offers the Palestinians. A very small part of their historical homeland, and giving up everything else. And that wasn't enough. You know, and that even that wasn't enough.
We have just 5 minutes left, and so we're going to have time. I know you guys have a lot of questions. You'll be able to talk to the speakers outside afterwards, but we're going to have time for maybe two or three from people who've been waiting for a bit. So, Hanan?
Well, first of all, I would like to congratulate you for your courage. I'm a Palestinian, and your honesty towards the whole thing makes me feel so proud that I have a Jewish guy who talks the same language I talk. So congratulations, Miko. And you really understand the situation. Like, seriously, you talk about it as if you lived it. I lived there. And I've, lived the misery of occupation and, the whole thing. And you talk about it as if you lived it. So thank you. The second thing is that I'm a little bit not as optimistic as you. I don't believe in two-state solution, but I also think that an apartheid system is gonna take a long time, and we might go through dark times, like maybe 30, 40 years until this resolved. This is for a simple fact, is that the Jewish community are still denying the rights of the Palestinians. They are still denying even the existence of the Palestinians on the land. And I think that the mainstream Israelis are even becoming more and more radical. So I don't know how, I mean, I know that the BDS movement is trying to put more pressure on Israel, but seriously, I don't.